The real version of St. Elmo's Fire by UI Lab, which was, of course, a collaboration between Stereo Lab and UI, and, of course, a cover of the original Brian Eno tune. And Slummin' with Montalban, also in there, Edie Swanks, and Migration by Bonobo. I'll be back next week with more new and old tunes for your listening pleasure. Have yourself a good week. Take care of yourselves. We'll leave you with our traditional goodbye track. Bye now.
Everybody happy? You can't come in. You can't come in.
To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed. The bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die. And the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men.
Welcome, everybody. This is Room Tone, the radio show. We talk movies because we love it. We bring the film community to your ears. And today, woo, today we're so lucky to have a film reporter from the Georgia Strait. Everybody raise your hands for Greg Takeuchi. How are you doing, Craig?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, pleasure to have you over here. All right. I say we just get right into it. First things first. What's your story, Craig?
My story?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a staff writer at the Georgia Strait. I'm an instructor at Langara College in creative writing. And I'm actually a UBC grad. I did a general BA in film studies and art history. And then I did an MFA in creative writing.
That's awesome right there. Shout out to UBC. We're actually here on CIRR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Ancira Maschium Land. And here we are about to explore a little bit the some of the pivotal aspects of storytelling and filmmaking. And we go back to, you know, as a journalist yourself, when it comes to communication outside of this of the theater, you know, that's pretty much the core of communication when it comes to you know, informing the community of what's going on and what's happening. And I want to ask you, as a journalist and reporter yourself, what do you think is one of the biggest challenges right now in 2018?
I would say the fact that we're competing against the entire world for audiences. Because when I started, we were focused on a weekly print edition. And I saw the shift go from that one weekly edition towards trying to get content online every few days, then every day, and now it's by the minute, almost by the second. Mm-hmm. And so that shift has really accelerated the pace that we're working at, and that creates a ton of challenges.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely it goes along with the evolution, you know, the virtual era right now, but we need to adapt. We need to adapt with what's happening. And how do you feel, especially in the realm of filmmaking, how do you feel the community has evolved and how has it changed? The flow of information, how has that flow of information changed in the context of filmmaking?
I would say now with the internet, obviously it's easier for filmmakers to upload content in a variety of different ways, whereas before I was much more restricted in terms of distribution channels. Like, you can now upload stuff to YouTube, you know, from your iPhone, or there's a lot more do-it-yourself stuff that can get your stuff out there through social media, stuff like that, which I think is much more beneficial in terms of when it comes to the subject that we'll probably talk about later is diversity, and getting diverse voices out there.
Yeah, let's get into that right now as well. We just mentioned that. Why not? Because that's actually how we met in the first place. We were at a conference of diversity in filmmaking, and I was struck by the communicative skills that Craig had, and the way he was talking was very, very interesting to me. So that's how we met, and he was talking about diversity and the representation of diversity in general communication today, especially, of course, filmmaking. And we as filmmakers, storytellers, we have to keep an eye on that always. What's your take on today's representation of diversity?
Well, there are a lot of aspects to it. I think that there has been quite a bit of progress made. I mean, I've been covering specifically the topic of representation of Asian men in film and TV for over the past possibly 20 years. It's what I actually started my writing career with. And unfortunately, it has been quite slow, particularly in certain areas, such as the representation of Asian men in as a romantic lead paired with a white woman. That's still rarely seen. But there has been progress in other areas. There are a lot more Asian North American TV series out there than there were ever before. There has been some sort of backtreading here and there. But in general, I think there has been a general growth overall. But there's still a long ways to go, I think.
How do you think we could improve, you know, as a community, as filmmakers? How could we actually raise the voice of the of unrepresented communities? I would say that's also a big issue right now. Many of the voices out there are not being represented.
It's a very complex issue. I don't think there's one answer. I think there's a variety of different things that people could do. I think it's one of the ways to do it is to think outside the box, to think outside your own experience, to think how diverse characters can actually add to your story, can actually add fresh elements, particularly when it comes to the idea of trying to find something that will attract attention in a new and fresh way. I think the examples of Black Panther and Wonder Woman, which I might cite frequently, are examples of how you can freshen and enliven a genre that has become a little bit repetitive and tired, particularly in the era where we are flooded with remakes, reboots. We're seeing the constant rehashing of the same material over and over again. One way to do that is to turn to diversity, because I think diversity offers the opportunity to create fresh stories that we haven't heard before and connect with audiences who have not been connected with before.
How do you feel about superhero movies?
Well, I think what is both encouraging and yet troubling at the same time is the fact that, for instance, with Wonder Woman, she had a TV series back, I believe it was in the 70s or 80s, which made her a household name, and yet it's taken this long for the big screen version to hit the theaters. And during that period, we had seen so many remakes of Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, still to this day. And there had been a few female superhero movies, but they hadn't done that quite. They hadn't done very, or they bombed actually. Like Catwoman, Elektra didn't do very well. But I think one of the problems was actually that those films were directed by men, and when I watched them, I felt like they weren't sure how to handle those characters.
Oh, interesting.
I feel like they were kind of uncertain who exactly they were appealing to. Like, it was like they're trying to reach the male fanboy audience and yet trying to balance it with a female audience. Whereas I feel like with Wonder Woman, which was directed by Patty Jenkins, I felt she was just trying to tell the story of this character, not whether it was male or female or who she was trying to reach. It was just trying to tell a really strong story. And I think that's why it was so successful. It just presented Wonder Woman as a character.
The purity of the story is forgotten sometimes, huh? That's when we get lost in the technique of things, and that's And that's a pity. I mean, we got to remind ourselves of the why we tell the story. And the character is the center. It underpins the whole story. And as you said, focusing on that definitely boosts the story. But even better, makes it deeper. Makes it more appealing. Makes it an actual story rather than just a following of events. Mm. Is there a movie or in specific that comes to your mind that has done that successfully apart from what you just mentioned? Maybe across your whole life, what movie you think has done that the most successfully?
Sorry, what do you mean in terms of a
character? Yeah, character building. I'm just curious. I'm just asking questions just to get to know a little bit more about each other. And in case there is a movie that you think has done its job very well when it comes to character building and even the exploration of diversity through the character.
Well, I mean, there are quite a number of really great character-driven films. And any examples that I would turn to would be more in the art house genre or area, or European films, or Asian art house films. But in terms of...
Well, if you don't, if it doesn't pop in your mind, you can just say like, "Oh, I don't have one in mind." No problem. No, okay. There is no invisible wall over here. It's just very, very. We flow just like water. Mm. But yeah, it's very interesting to hear this because we have to talk about this. We have to talk about this. There is no more time to waste. We have to tackle these issues now. This is the time, and I was very happy to hear those words from you even at the conference and even right now, you know, knowing that there are people that care about this and we can't close an eye on it. And you as well as an instructor, you know, how do you see the students nowadays? Where do you see them going?
Well, I teach creative writing in the continuing studies department at Langara. And you're talking about in terms of where they will go as a career, or
students somehow are a projection of the future, right? And I'm wondering what you see in them and how you think they can, through creative writing, they can change or raise the bar, even in the context of diversity.
I would say that in terms of the stories that students are writing, I think there's a broader range now that students feel much more comfortable in terms of writing stories that are, say, LGBT, about their experiences as an ethnic minority. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more encouragement for that and a lot more support. But I think in terms of writing, there has always been interest in that area because I feel that readers are interested in learning about other people's experiences. And I think that's very different from movies in terms of entertainment, which is different from cinema. Mm-hmm. Hollywood movies are entertainment, and those are works in which people want to escape. They don't necessarily want to be confronted, and I wouldn't say they necessarily want to learn. I would say that they want to escape their own troubles. They want to escape their own life, which is different from cinema, which teaches about life. Or actually, you mentioned you had a really good way of putting it earlier.
There is something about movies and cinema. Yeah, cinema is, and movies, as you said, are very different, right? And movies can be seen as a sort of escapism, you know, escaping from life. But cinema is an exploration of life, you know. And I think that's very true, you know, because education lives in stories, and movies are stories at a maximum potential, you know. So when looking at what cinema can do for our society on a bigger scale, you know, I get extremely excited, and I'm very optimistic that the generations that are rising right now are willing to learn and are willing to explore and utilize this medium for the best and for the better of the community and the society.
Yeah, and actually that is something that also concerns me in terms more to do with Hollywood and the insidious nature of entertainment, because when you're consuming entertainment, you're not thinking critically necessarily. You're absorbing a lot of embedded values unconsciously and not thinking about it critically. Whereas when you're watching cinema, it's like going to an art gallery where you're automatically looking at something in a sort of critical or experiential way. With movies, you can sometimes absorb a lot without realizing it. And particularly with the domination of Hollywood and the colonization of international markets, that's problematic because that is spreading American values throughout the world and influencing the world through that sort of subconscious absorption and absorbing it uncritically.
I love it. Give me a high five in the booth, Craig. Amazing. Yeah, that was a beautiful breakdown right there. Very precise, very neat. And yeah, there are many values that are embedded in the movies that we watch, and sometimes they just become part of us. We don't even notice, you know? That's that we are made of stories. Human beings are a walking story, you know? The way some people walk is art, you know? We are art, living art that breathes, and we absorb everything that comes through us, you know? That we like it or not. And that's what's happening with movies. Yeah. Is there an example or something specific you would like to talk about or point at when it comes to, you know, absorbing values? In the past years?
Well, I think there are a number of examples in terms of problematic films, in terms of representation of diversity. But I think there's a lot of progress in that area too. Like, for instance, traditionally, LGBT characters were always represented as either the villain, they ended up dying. And when you absorb that, either as an LGBT person or as a non-LGBT person, it gives you a very pessimistic and negative view of LGBT people. Whereas now, the integration of LGBT characters into the mainstream really helps to counter some of those negative stereotypes, negative values or perceptions that continue to be a problem today. And that goes with any minority character, I think.
Thank you for saying that. That is gold, you know. When filmmakers, directors, writers, producers, there is a responsibility because every character represents an ideal, represents a collective of identities in society. And there is nothing more precious than that. You know, needs to be taken care of just like a little baby who's just born. And we need to make sure that whatever we put into that script or into that story serves somehow in a positive sense, in a positive way, to the values. We can't forget about the values.
Actually, there is also a mental health component to that, because what people don't realize is that when they're watching these films, they're subconsciously absorbing things that shape their own self-image. I had once interviewed a First Nations man. Unfortunately, I can't think of his name off the top of my head. But it was to do with film, and it was to do with the representations of Indigenous and First Nations people in film. And he said growing up, he had always watched cowboys and Indian films. And the Native or First Nations characters always died at the end. And he grew up with a subconscious idea that he would have to die at a certain age, because he had watched them at such a young age. That was embedded in him. And I think sometimes people don't realize, and filmmakers may not realize, the impact of what they're doing in terms of representation. They may not think, oh, you know, it's not a big deal, it's just a story, it's just fiction. But unfortunately, when that's all you see, when that's the totality of what's being reflected back to you, that has a huge impact on your psyche. That goes in terms of the high rates of mental health issues and suicide amongst LGBT people. It also has a great impact in terms of ethnic minorities, whether you're Black, Asian, Latino. All of those things have an impact on in terms of mental health.
They do that. Thank you for saying that. These are very important things. I really, you know, I feel, you know, woo! I feel the fire within, because these things, we got to talk about these, you know. We got to let them out.
Yeah.
And it's such a pleasure to have you here, Craig. And now I think it's about time to take a little break. And I actually want to talk about the soundtrack that you chose. And you chose the soundtrack of Pina, the beautiful documentary about dance. And I want to ask you, why did that soundtrack come through your mind?
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, right now?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do it.
Well, it's a beautiful documentary. It's it was a 3D documentary, which is rare, mm-hmm. All about dance, and I love dance. And it's rare to see a film such a big budget production all about dance. But also, part of the reason why I suggested the soundtrack is that it's very varied. There's quite a range. There's a lot of introspective, moody, reflective tracks. A lot of intimate tracks, as well as there's some jazzy, upbeat, flirtatious tracks. So I thought it might give you a variety to play.
Yeah, the documentary is one of my favorite documentaries. It's definitely very, very powerful, and it reaches in all sorts of directions. And I think that it actually fits so well with today's episode, because there's such a variety and a strong, you know, it reaches in every direction, in every sense. And when I think about Pina, I think about diversity, you know, because the dancers, so many different dancers with so many different voices, you know, that, of course, they express through dance. And today, actually, right now, I want to go to this very, very interesting upbeat song that it comes from one specific dance that really struck me in the movie, which is such a simple dance, but still not easy to perform at all. And it's just performed with the hands of this character. And this is actually a song I found it to be... very, very, very cool song. Very, very, whoo, very. It's got its own flow. But this is from Caetano Veloso, a very, very powerful dance in the movie Pina. Enjoy. This is Leonzinho.
Gosto muito de te ver, Leonzinho, caminhando sob o sol. Gosto muito de você, Leãozinho. Para desentristecer, Leãozinho, o meu coração tão só. Basta eu encontrar você no caminho. Um filhote de leão, um raio da manhã, arrastando meu olhar como um imã. O meu coração é o sol, pai de toda cor. Quando ele lhe doura a pele ao léu. Gosto de te ver ao sol, Leãozinho, de te ver entrar no mar. Tua pele, tua luz, tua juba. Gosto de ficar ao sol, Leãozinho, de molhar minha juba, de estar perto de você e entrar no mar. Gosto muito de te ver, Leãozinho, caminhando sob o sol. Gosto muito de você, Leãozinho. Para desentristecer, Leãozinho, o meu coração tão só. Basta eu encontrar você no caminho. Um filhote de leão, um raio da manhã, arrastando meu olhar como um imã. O meu coração é o sol, pai de toda cor. Quando ele lhe doura a pele ao léu. Gosto de te ver ao sol, Leãozinho, de te ver entrar no mar. Tua pele, tua luz, tua juba.
Gosto de ficar ao sol, leãozinho, de molhar minha juba, de estar perto de você e entrar no mar.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Room Tone, the radio show. We talk movies because we love it. And today we're joined by Craig Takeuchi from the Georgia Strait, film reporter and instructor, talking about diversity on a beautiful sunny day here in Vancouver. How beautiful is Vancouver? Wow. Okay, Craig, let's get right into it. Again, back again into diversity because it's something we have to talk about right now. And we can't really ignore, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
We have to absolutely get into it all the way through, dive into it, head dive into it. And that's why I want to ask you, how do you see the representation of diversity in 10 years?
I would say it's a little bit tough to say. Because in terms of what I've seen over the past two or so decades, progress is incredibly slow. But I have noticed that we seem to be at a bit of a turning point, or there have been a few pivotal moments over the past 1 or 2 years. And so that gives me a lot of hope for the future. And I would say I'm not sure where we'll be in 10 years, but my hope is that there will be a significant upturn, or that perhaps we're on an accelerated curve. That maybe things have gone slow in the past, but maybe we'll increase in the number of representations of minority characters in the future.
Absolutely. I think there are a couple of examples out there right now as well, right?
I guess the most recent one, and the one that's sort of semi-breaking news, is Scarlett Johansson withdrawing from the film Rub and Tug, in which she was originally going to play a transgender character. There was a lot of protest on social media. There was a lot of concern expressed about it. And she had initially defended herself and the role. But she changed her mind and she relented and she apologized, which is quite interesting. And it's also interesting in the fact that there have been cisgender, or people who are born identifying with the biological gender I'm not explaining it well. As opposed to transgender people, in the past there have been cisgender actors who have been cast in transgender roles, like Jared Leto in Dallas Buyers Club, for which he won an Oscar. Felicity Huffman in Transamerica, who won a Golden Globe, but they didn't relinquish those roles. Whereas now, I think there's a lot more vocal support for transgender actors, because what I should explain, that if some people don't understand, is that the problem with casting an actor who is not of that minority character's background is that, for instance, an actor like Scarlett Johansson, she can play a lot of different roles. She can play like a white female lead character. She's been cast, strangely, in Ghost in the Shell, which was originally a Japanese character. Whereas a transgender actor may not be cast in some of those roles. They may be limited to only transgender roles. And for somebody who has the privilege and ability to play a diverse range, like Scarlett Johansson, is taking away the opportunity from a transgender actor. It's the same with any other roles. For instance, a white straight male actor playing a gay role, which has happened a lot in the past. Everybody from Tom Hanks to Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger in Brokeback Mountain. That's taking away opportunities from gay male actors who may not be cast as a straight romantic lead because they're perceived as gay.
Ah, look at that, eh? Yeah. That's definitely, whoo, that's very stingy right there. That's definitely something to talk about. Well, there are many. I feel that, of course, there are so many variables. There's so much that happens around it, and it's that's why it's so hard to talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
And probably the people that get down to make that decision is probably one or two, right? Maybe three.
Yeah.
You know? And but still that decision is then channeled on a, such a bigger scale, right? And the consequences are bigger than just making that one choice from that one or two people, one person, two people, three people.
Well, actually, when I was at the Vancouver Asian Film Festival panel discussion about diversity, there was a person in the audience who asked, you know, is there a way to cast actors who are not of a certain ethnicity in a role that might be different? And I realize now, like, it does happen. Even in Asian films, sometimes there will be a Japanese actor playing a Chinese role, or vice versa. But I think the difference is that when it's a production, film production within that culture, and there are people immersed within that culture who understand the nuances of casting somebody who is from a different culture or ethnicity, they understand the sensitivities and they understand how that character or actor will be read as. Whereas it's different in Hollywood, where the casting director may not be sensitive to those nuances or differences or understand the political consequences of what they're doing. And so because they're not immersed in that culture, or they're from outside that culture, they may be doing it quite ignorantly, if they don't have a consultant, if they don't properly research that issue. For instance, if they cast, for instance, like a Korean actor as a Japanese actor, to the mass audience in North America, they may think, oh, you know, there's no problem, he looks Asian. But to people from that culture, they will be able to see differences in their look, their body language, their speech patterns, a lot of those things that are very significant and would be read as inauthentic. And unfortunately, if you don't know those differences, then you'll just gloss them over.
Absolutely. You know, that really resonates, because, and I think it resonates with so many people out there, because, you know, even personally, I'm from Italy, right? And there are some movies that just, they say, oh, you're Italian, and then la la la, and then they move the head. It's true, we do that stuff, but, you know, like the way we speak, there is a whole, there are so many dialects in the country, there is so much to it, and sometimes the representation is superficial, right? And same thing that can be applied to any culture out there. And I think that, as you said, there is a sense of research that needs to be nurtured, you know? We need to be researching more and more, because things are growing constantly, and we can't just let them slip by like that, you know? There are identities at stake. And, you know, identity is you know, that's a great, great question, actually, that I've always asked myself. And how would you define identity?
How would I define?
How would you define, the concept of identity?
Oh, that's a huge question.
It's a huge question, eh? It's tough, eh?
I don't know if you can... well, it really depends, because identity can be very personal in terms of what you identify with. Because I know some people who are of mixed heritage who don't really acknowledge certain parts of their ethnic heritage. They don't see themselves... Like, for instance, I know a few Japanese-Canadian people who don't necessarily identify themselves as Japanese-Canadian. They just see themselves as Canadians. But that can also depend upon so many factors. It can depend upon where they grew up in. For instance, if they grew up in a rural area where they're predominantly surrounded by Caucasian people, and they felt the need to blend in because they didn't want to feel different from everybody else. It could depend upon their relationships with their parents or grandparents, whether or not they were exposed at a young age to their heritage, stuff like that. So it's very complicated, I think.
It is. It is probably, it is very complicated, because it might be a balance, you know, between, it's a duality, right? Something more internal and something more external. And what I mean with that is there is an internal realm and reality of identity, and how someone, you know, perceives him or herself. But at the same time, that is something that bounces back from the outside, you know, because then society is a mirror as well, right? Mm. And, you know, we are able to look at ourselves through somebody else, mm-hmm. you know? And it's a balance between that process of looking on the outside and diving in the inside. And that's why it's such a delicate topic again, because balance is never steady. You can never just, you know, take a picture of it and there it is, you know? Mm. It's a constant flow. And it's actually the only thing that never perpetuates, that never stands still, is change. And that identity is change, is a constant flow. It's just like, it's a constant flow, and we can't control it sometimes. Sometimes identity controls ourselves, but that's a longer topic. Let's not get lost in there. But yeah, it's definitely a big topic. We have to talk about these things, you know? Mm. And especially because identity and you know, when you identify with a movie, that is also identity, you know? Is there a movie you specifically identify with? Maybe that gave you something in your life and gave you an additional part of yourself.
I say no. Is that a problem?
No. You can say no. That's not a problem. Not at all.
I don't know if there are movies that I necessarily identify with. There are movies that I was inspired by or that I greatly admire. But I can't say there is a film that I necessarily identify with.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. It's a very, again, it's a personal topic, you know. Mm. There is an infinite number of answers to these questions. And that's why we ask these questions, you know. We're here to explore those infinite possibilities, you know. That's the beauty of it, right? Mm. And cinema is infinite as well, because again, the possibilities of and the different branches of communication, they just end up in so many different directions. Mm. And I think that when we have such a broad world ahead of us, going always back to the same patterns and the same stereotypes, maybe can be limiting.
Mm. Well, going back to what we're talking about earlier in terms of how diversity can create fresh material by presenting new aspects to a story, I think there have been a lot of really interesting examples recently to do with deafness or deaf characters and the use of sign language, which hasn't been consistently represented in film. And I think there's been a lot of progress made recently.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, it was back in the 80s, I think it was 1986, when Marlee Matlin won the best actress Oscar for Children of a Lesser God.
Okay.
That was way back in 1986, and she's the only one who ever the only deaf performer who won that category. Since then, most recently, in the past year, there have been two or three movies that have significantly used American Sign Language as an integrated part of the story. One of the most interesting examples was A Quiet Place, a horror movie, which was about a family trying to survive this invasion by these strange creatures. And it was quite interesting because they had to be quiet in order to avoid being tracked down by these monsters.
Mm.
And so the whole family used American Sign Language, because actually one of the characters, the daughter, she was deaf.
Oh, okay.
And it was played by a deaf actress, Millicent Simmons, I mm-hmm. believe. And that was a way in which American Sign Language was actually integrated into the story. It wasn't just a token character or anything like that. And then another example was The Shape of Water. In which the main character, she wasn't deaf, but she was mute. She couldn't speak. And she used sign language to communicate. But if you want to see actually an even better example that I think that was riffing off of, was the 1990s film, I think it was 1993, Jane Campion's The Piano, in which the lead character was a very strong-willed female character who was mute, but used sign language to communicate. And her daughter, played by Anna Paquin, spoke for her.
Wow. Yeah. These stories tap into very, very, very particular places. And for example, in The Shape of Water, I feel that one of the scene when she communicated with Sanders, that was one of the most powerful scenes. Hmm. Extremely moving, you know, like especially with the subtitles and what she was saying, you know, it was extremely powerful. And
well, especially with film being a visual medium, sign language, you know, to express yourself it adds to the visual element of the film, and it creates a, you know, a distinct image for the film, the moviegoer.
Yeah, well said right there. Yeah. Definitely. Well, it's definitely a moment of transition, and so many things are happening. But when we remind ourselves of what truly matters and how that and when that is translated and communicated in alternative ways. Hmm. Oh, that really taps deep, you know? And when those alternative ways will not be alternative anymore, then that's probably when we will have reached a stage of, I wouldn't call it enlightenment, it's a big word, but a stage of success for our community, for our society.
And I think also when there are diverse characters introduced, whether it's deaf, disability, ethnic minorities, it helps viewers think about experiences that are different from their own, and that creates an interesting element for the moviegoer, and to freshen up content, so we're not seeing the same things over and over mm-hmm. again. We're not constantly seeing the white straight male experience. We're seeing a variety of experiences that actually add to the storytelling mm-hmm. and tell the story in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that's wonderful right there. You know what? Talking about something new, something particular, something a little special. We're actually gonna go to the next song from the soundtrack of Pina, and this is the way Craig described it to me, with mood and intimate, and it is definitely like that. And if you allow it, it will take you very far. It's a very, very special song, and if you're listening out there, just take your time to dream a little bit, close your eyes. You know, get into this alternate world that this song is about to take you. And I'll catch you up right after the little break to wrap it up with Craig. So everybody enjoy. This is the soundtrack of Pina. It's called Memoir du Futur.
Thank you.
Wow, Craig, how do you feel about it? Woo, that was special, eh? Where are you right now? Where did it take you?
The song always makes me think of a duet, intimate duet between two dancers who are expressing like a tentative flirtation or sort of dancing around each other very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Definitely the intimacy. It almost feels like a witch trying to charm you in a way.
Such a
taste, you know? And those instruments sometimes picking it up, it's almost like, again, it's a balance, it's a flow, right?
Mm.
A little bit over here, ooh, a little bit over there, ooh, oh, ah, ooh, the little note over there, ah, you know? What a song right there, yeah. I guess it's time to get into the 1 minute pitching.
Uh-oh.
Are you ready for that?
Okay.
Woo-hoo. Craig has an amazing idea today. He's pitching something a little bit different, but it's so special. Are you ready? You let me know when you're ready. I'm gonna make that clock happen. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. The clock is going.
Okay. So my pitch is a bit of a challenge. I would like to challenge anyone out there to organize an effort to raise funds for a Canadian-only movie theater in Vancouver. What's really unfortunate is that it is very difficult for Canadian films to get on our own screens, which is a really sad commentary. Unfortunately, Canadian films have to compete against Hollywood films, which have hugely massive budgets compared to Canadian films. And that's really unfair for our own Canadian film industry. So to have a theater devoted strictly to screening Canadian films would help our domestic industry so much. It would provide jobs for our domestic industry and allow our own talent to be seen and not constantly have to go to the U.S.
Awesome, right on, and that's the watch right there. So that's pretty good timing right there, and that's an amazing idea. I think, I don't know why nobody has thought about that earlier, you know, like
I think people have. It's just the difficulty of actually getting it done and finding the funding for it, which is actually the biggest challenge
for sure. Yeah, it's a challenge, but if it wasn't a challenge, then where would that beauty be, right? You need that challenge sometimes. And I think it's time to get into the Proust questionnaire. We're gonna pick five questions of those 35 questions from Proust. Proust wrote down 35 questions believing that they would help us forge or spot someone's true identity. So talking about identity, there we go again. But let me start and go, because as a journalist yourself, I need to ask you, who are your favorite writers?
I would say not so much as a journalist, but as a creative writer or writer of fiction. I would say my favorite authors are Arundhati Roy, the Indian writer who wrote The God of Small Things, as well as, I would say, one of my top writers would be Marguerite Duras, the French writer. She wrote The Lover, which was turned into a movie. But she also wrote a number of other novels. I would say those are my two top ones. There are a number of Japanese writers who I like a few of the short stories. One is The Catch by Kenzaburo Oe. And I also highly admire the personal essay by Junichiro Tanizaki.
Wow, these are so many names. Like, we better write them down and make some research up in here. Woo-hoo, look at that. Is there a specific type of reading that you do? Is there a specific a genre specifically when you look for books that you look out for?
Not necessarily. It really depends. The most recent book I read was a memoir, nonfiction, called Educated by Tara Westover, which is about a woman who was raised within a cult in I think it was Montana.
Oh, wow.
Or it was in a rural area in the Midwest, and she was homeschooled not very well, and she was deprived of medical help because her parents were extremists. I think they were Mormon fundamentalists or very extreme religious believers. And she turn to education to escape that, and she eventually acquired a PhD.
Okay.
Which was incredible. It was an incredible story. I highly recommend it.
Wow, interesting. All right. Yeah. Woo! And that leads us to the second question of the Proust questionnaire. We're going to increase the speed a little bit. We're going to increase the pace a little bit. And which living person do you most admire?
I would say there are quite a few, but one of them is the artist Andy Goldsworthy, a British artist who uses natural materials to create installations in nature. And so he's not introducing anything foreign. He's just rearranging nature and turning them into these amazing shapes and sculptures and stuff like that.
Wonderful. All right. Woo. Let's moonwalk to the third question of the Proust questionnaire. What is your current state of mind?
I would say fragmented. I've got too many thoughts racing through my head
okay.
right now.
Awesome right there. Woo. Fourth question of the Proust questionnaire. What is your greatest fear?
I would say locally that the city continues to overdevelop and redevelop at the expense of culture.
Mm-hmm. Woo! And last question of the Proust questionnaire, what is your idea of perfect happiness?
I would say playing with kittens and the smell of fresh laundry.
Awesome. Wonderful. Woo. Oh, wow. Awesome. That wraps up the Proust questionnaire. And to wrap it up, I want to ask you if you have any shout outs to do. And what's your advice for storytellers out there?
I would say advice for storytellers. One of the toughest things is detaching yourself from your work. So that you can edit it or receive feedback about it and not take any criticism personally. That is a really tough thing to do. It's something that can really help with your writing. Shout outs. I haven't really thought about it. Nothing comes to the top of my head. But
no worries.
Yeah.
If I guess that's a great piece of advice, the detachment to it, to the art is definitely something not easy to do. But once you're able to do it, woo! So much positive comes out of it, right?
Mm, yeah.
Now, to wrap it up, of course, this soundtrack of Pina. Mm. Launch it. Launch it, Craig. Okay. Launch us through the song of through the final song of the show. Make it happen, Craig. Are you ready?
Yeah. So this is Lilies of the Valley by Jun Miyake.
Awesome. See you next Monday, guys. Ciao, ciao. Enjoy life. Thank you.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. This is a repeat episode. Please be advised, references to date and time may not be applicable at this time. Enjoy the show.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to